it's great hearing all those spontaneous poems, and sometimes the best poetry is written that way. I do a lot of workshops, and often the poems that people write spontaneously will be much better than anything they have brought with them to workshop. And I don't know why that is, other than I think that we're just not outthinking ourselves. And of course, I believe in revision. I revise and revise and revise, but there is something about that first draft that is beautifully raw. And then what I heard tonight was quite stunning. And I'm not going to say too many. I won't let my students make disclaimers. You have a disclaimer jar, and you have a fund every time you say you're not as good as the person before you. You have to put a quarter in the jar for the lepers. We don't have lepers anymore, but for some good cause. And I do it myself. I make more disclaimers than anyone. I'm going to read a couple of newish poems to start. They come from the series that Paul mentioned, the Goodness of This World. My daughter is now 25. She was on the street from about the time she was 15, I guess, but always kept in touch with me, and we're very, very close. And so it's a very hard time for me, really, because this is the worst nightmare you can imagine when this happens. But it's very common in Canada. I have lots of people who come and want to talk to me about what do they do because their daughter, son, whatever, 20, 25, 30, is doing the same thing. And it's really, I think that it touches everybody. I don't know about in Ireland, but it certainly is a North American problem. And this part, I try to write about her addiction with a sense of humor, because it's all so tragic. If you don't keep a sense of humor, that's true of most things in life, it will bring you down. And so part three, the title is God Loves a Drug Dealer, which is a graffiti I saw somewhere. She forced you to cut your hair, hack it off in front of those you counted as friends, but failed you in the end. Next time she'd make you shave your eyebrows too, she said, and sent you back onto the street with what was left of your dignity. This girl sells the heroin you can't live without. She said she would donate your hair to a good cause like cancer, and I thought, trust you to find a drug dealer with a social conscience. I have learned not to ask why, but then I opened the door and saw you standing small in your nakedness, the kind of nakedness that can never again be clothed. I cried and cradled your head while you, wise as ever, said, Mum, it will grow back, it's only hair. But your hurt goes deep. You were the child I suffered for, your long hair streaming as you ran wild into the wind with your imaginary friends. While other mothers snipped price tags off back-to-school fashions, I sat by your bed in the intensive care unit, watching your vital signs blip across a screen. You were barely 14. You'd had enough of being alive. I lift your head from the pillow. The summer sun had streaked your hair faintly gold and brushed thin strands from your face. I could almost feel you want to live again by the grace as your hair slipped through my hands. Okay, this is, that's not going to work. This is great. I'm tripping over this thing. After 50 years of reading with a microphone, I still don't know how to use one. It's amazing. Each one's different, is the problem. So this is the last in the series so far, and I had a grant to write more, but they were so hard to write that I stopped because I couldn't go on. So I've got to find the ending of this one. There it is. But the good news is, last October she was arrested on some warrants. She hadn't gone to court, she should have, and I had 24 hours. Either she was going to prison or I could get her into detox and recovery, which again is a huge industry now in North America. So I chose the first place I found on the internet, which was Canada's, I didn't see the small print, I was so upset, Canada's Luxury Recovery, and it cost me about $40,000, which is about 20,000 euros? A lot of money anyway. My mom helped me out, I didn't have the money, I kind of borrowed from everybody I knew. And I figured it was a waste of money. She escaped three times, out the window, over balconies, smuggled back in needles and everything, but then she just kind of gave up. And so a year later, she's now teaching children how to ride horses in Alberta, and she's at college. She sends me text saying, Mom, you just used a comma splice in your email. So, things do turn around. So there's actually a happy ending to these very sad poems. And I haven't shown her the pamphlet, the chapbook that came out, because I think she'd feel too guilty, and I don't want her to, but that's one day. Anyway, so this is the last one in the series. We were driving. I vowed to take you away from the life you were leaving for good. The heroin you'd stashed for the journey ran out around Nanus Bay, where we pulled in at a rest area so you could do your last fix in the privacy of the blue port-a-loo. I got out of the car to wait and found in the dead grass at the edge of the parking lot a suitcase full of someone else's life, recipes, spices whose expiry date had been and gone, a bottle of vanilla extract, the kind I let you sniff when we used to bake cookies together. Lately you had taken to drinking the supersized containers I bought at Costco. You said it helped you sleep when the drugs ran out. I'd begun hiding it and the knives I found in your bedroom under your pillow. I removed them without saying anything, so terrified had I become of your fate. In that parking lot, I unpacked cutlery, saucepans with lids missing, a single baby shoe. I worked loose the knot on a bundle of unopened letters with footprints over them, then stopped as you came flailing back to me because someone had dumped a lifetime of family photographs in the outhouse toilet pit, and up until that point, it was the saddest thing I knew. We got in the car and drove, trying to imagine had she been kicked out of her house or had she run away. Maybe she chucked everything before checking into the rehab facility on the hill, hoping to start anew. I didn't want to go on. I wanted to turn back, open the letters, find a clue, a name, an address to return the things to. But you said it was useless, and I could feel the panic rising in you. And I had little strength left at that time, and I was driving, and you need both hands to hold someone who is suffering and does not want to be held. So this is a poem. I spent quite a lot of time in Ireland. I lived out in Malin Moor in the early 70s on near Clifton, which is quite a different place than it is now. You can now buy Jamaican jerk sauce there. In those days, you could just buy cabbages and a few carrots and processed cheese, PLT cheese. It was quite a shock to me to come back and find it had changed. And so I've come back every year since I moved back to Canada with my mother, which is why I got invited here. So I think Paul heard that I came every year with my mom. This is the first time she hasn't come with me in about 20 years. She's now 88, but it's a long trip from the west coast of Canada. It's about 9 or 10 hours on the plane. I don't blame her for not. The travel part's been desperate. But anyway, so I have a real connection, especially with the west. And this is a poem I wrote on our last trip together. It's called On the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown in the West of Ireland. I thought I could do a whole series on a verge of a nervous breakdown in Cork, a verge of, everywhere I've been. But it might get a bit monotonous. So anyway, I was staying at Cashel House. Mom always chose these beautiful places to stay and pay for it all. It's been a real shock for me to have to come on my own and pay for myself, I must say. But it has been a kind of a relief because if I ever did things like go for a walk, she was convinced I was going to leave her and disappear, or I'd be killed in a car crash and she'd be stuck somewhere. I wouldn't be able to get home. So I couldn't really, it was like having a child with me all the time. I couldn't do things like go to Clare Island, which is why I did, because she doesn't like boats either. So I've had a great time this time, just being free. But anyway, this is the poem, A Nervous Breakdown in the West of Ireland. You don't die from grief. She said this as she opened the gate to her sister Mary's garden. Mary died in a car accident the same day Kate received two flats of seedlings her sister sent in the mail. Grief comes down like a grave-digging rain, like the cries of the dotty rooster in the potting shed, where two black kittens with starving eyes make my world smaller, seem so much more cruel. I weep every morning climbing the steep hill to Mary's garden, where the wind scatters the fuchsia blossoms and gathers me as I walk. I button my coat against the breathing day, then, as the wind blows through me anyway, my heart changes, and in that tender wavering, I let grief in. I think part of the reason I was always on the verge of a nervous breakdown was that I was with my mother, worries about everything. We'd be driving across the bog, and she'd say, I'd see this worried look, and I'd say, what now, Mom? Well, the window's open and my book marker is in my paperback, and I'm afraid it's going to blow out and I'll lose my place. So I thought I was a saint. I said, we'll stop the car, we'll put the paperback in your purse where the wind can't blow. Anyway, by the end of 2 weeks, I really need a holiday. And I get home and people say, how was your holiday? I said, I need a holiday. I usually buy Irish poetry when I'm here and I travel around. It's sort of my solace. And Paul Durkin is a poet I always loved, and he came over to the west of Canada to a festival, and we had him to stay for a few days. And anyway, so I love his poetry so much, I thought I should write some poems almost in his voice to kind of exercise his voice from, otherwise I might start writing older poems. So in these poems, his collected poems figure prominently, and there's six of them. I'm just going to read the last, which is called What Peace We Often Forfeit. So here I am traveling around with this quite thick book of collected poems. Because I feared Aer Lingus Flight 374 would explode in mid-air en route from Shannon to London over the Irish Sea, I took on board with me the selected poems of Paul Durkin. That way I would have something to cling on to, something to clutch that would forever be a comfort to me, with Mr. Garvey in the seat next to me, an explosives expert on his way to London to deliver a lecture, and my mother in the aisle seat set to go off. when he wasn't defusing bombs, so to speak, Mr. Garvey said, he spent his time writing verse, specifically about terrorism and generally about agricultural practices in Ireland during the famine, most of which were bleak. Mr. Garvey knew, too, many of the poems of Paul Durkin, having been privileged to memorize them during his term at Mullingar Mental Hospital. As we dipped over the Irish Sea, he said he'd always feared the resurgence of his insanity. Would I let him wear my copy of the selected poems of Paul Durkin on his knee, or better still, around his neck as a kind of oxygen mask or a life jacket? This is how I came to part with my solitary copy of the selected poems of Paul Durkin. I felt considerably ill at ease until we landed at London's Heathrow, where Mr. Garvey wanted to know would I accompany him to dinner, and an old film starring Mickey Rourke in Leicester Square, the one where he blows up a school bus full of innocent school children. Only Mr. Garvey said, so-called innocent school children, and for that he was not allowed to leave the plane. Nor, as far as I know, board any other, not ever. I left him sitting there, row 3, seat B, the poems of Paul Durkin open on his knee. Strange bird, my mother said, as we boarded our Canadian flight, the one that would carry us on home after a brief stop to refuel in Calgary. When the hot meal was served somewhere over Reykjavik, my mother poked around in it and seemed pleased. I'm glad this chicken doesn't have a bone, she said. I wondered how I was going to cope. Thank you. So you can see where the nervous breakdowns come from. Or as John Lennon called the nervous bread vans, which I quite like, but I thought that might be too confusing to call them. And this is when I almost, in 1970, when I first came to Ireland, I almost blew off the cliffs of Moher. There wasn't anything there then, there was just a trail to it, and of course there still isn't in guardrail in Canada, there'd be armed guards keeping you miles from the edge, but you know, here you can walk right. Well, this gust of wind picked me up, it was about 115 pounds, and slammed me away from the cliffs. I imagine a prevailing wind would usually do that, but in my mind I thought, what if it had gone the other way? I wouldn't be here today. But anyway, so this one is called We Count Them Happy Who Endure. It's another Paul Durkin. After the cliffs of Moher, we took the road inland to have tea and cheese toasties at Kilfenora. That's because of his poem, The Kilfenora Tea Party. So I actually went to Kilfenora because of that poem. That was great to be able to find places. I'm so excited to see the sign to Kilfenora. Even though my mother was tired, I read her the poem I had written to my father, who, when the time came, wouldn't fit in his coffin. I suppose it's lovely, she told me, and probably true, but I don't understand a word of it. Later, in an Ennis Diamond guest house, while my mother rested, I found in the selected poems of Paul Durkin a poem where his mother said she did not comprehend a word of his new poem book, the poems he had composed to his dead father. I wanted to read my mother this poem, too, and say, look, Mum, Paul's mother feels the same as you. But I didn't, not yet. Instead, I took her back to the black coast of Doolin and Doonbeg, where the water black was the color of my father's dying light. Black. Black. You, Paul, of all, might understand that. That came from when he came to dinner and I cooked a lamb stew, so he thought I was a gourmet cook. But I said something and he said to me, ah, Susan, you're black, black. So I guess it must have been something about my sense of humor, black. It's often not understood in Canada, so I don't really understand black sense of humors. I do live on Haida Gwaii. People here know Haida Gwaii, formerly the Queen Charlotte Islands, but a colonial name which the Haida First Nations don't like because the Queen Charlotte brought smallpox to the island and population fell from 30,000 to 800 in 10 years, so not a popular ship. But it's a political thing. Anyway, Haida Gwaii sounds poetic, it's great. And I wrote a series of very short poems called the Sangin, or Obituary of Light, the Sangin River Meditations. And these are, well, I live on a river called the Sangin River. And it was a kind of a Zen period of my life, I guess. I'm an aspiring Buddhist, of course. I'll never be one because I don't get it. I mean, I get it, but I waited for a pill to help me meditate. When that's invented, I might be able to do it a bit better. The will is there, but you know, dear. Anyway, so they're in four seasons, and this is the first. After the first snowfall, I find a winter wren frozen on the forest path. Who could have imagined it? Even the birds are freezing. As I push through earth, locked in sorrow in ice, find a hollow between rocks where her body will lie, a winter wren lights on the handle of my shovel. And then this is two. Across the river, children are eating snow, their lips the color of tiny kingfishers in the numbing cold. The delight they take in the melting of each snowflake on their tongues reminds me, joy is there in everything, and even when we can't see it. I'm afraid to say I don't actually believe that. That's probably my happiest poem. Mm-hmm. I had a lodger once called Joy, and it ruined the word for me. I had to move out of my own house to get away from it. Words have these awful reverberations, you know. It's the problem with poetry. You use a word you think is perfect, and then someone else says, not Joy, please. This one, one summer, my friend's dog, three dogs died, and I wrote the short meditation for their dogs. I have since discovered that if you put people's dogs' names in a poem, you'll sell multiple copies of your book. So there's a hint for you. I have a cookbook coming out where I have pictures of people's dogs. I figure this dog would be worth 10 copies each. As many dogs as I can to put in my bread recipe. It's really bizarre. I talk about having a sourdough starter that's like a pet, so I make a connection. But I know my editor is going to say, no, like the 25 dog pictures, a bit overkill for you. How empty the white bowl by the back door waiting to be filled. Lonely the cracked rubber ball, sad the comforter abandoned on the grass. Fetch, Death said, and they left to chase the wind. Three good dogs, Bubba, Mikey, and Shlugu. So I read that at the launch of this book, and a dog in the audience howled. He went, arrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrr hope for a better response, you know, reads the things that happen at readings. And this one, I've been thinking this the whole time I've been in Ireland, because when you're traveling, you tend to look at things and notice things, and everything's so interesting, right, everywhere I go. A young girl pulls herself along like a broken cricket, her face surrounded by pale sunlight, like Jesus. In a magazine I find at the laundromat, I read, "We travel to faraway places to watch in fascination the kind of people we ignore at home." In the margin, someone has written, "Why do we do this?" Exactly. And it's, I always know when fall is coming. I really love autumn. I love it here. I love the wind off the Atlantic. It's very different than the Pacific. The Atlantic has teeth, Pacific rolls. But at home, when it's starting to fall, there are a few alder leaves on the road every year. I guess they're probably different leaves here, but anyway, and we have these feral cows who wander the roads, and they're a great danger, actually, because if you hit one, well, it ruins your car and probably could kill you. But I have to warn all the tourists. I have a guest house up on these islands. I have to say, be careful driving up the beach. You don't run into a feral cow. No one believes me until they see the herd. And they're worse than deer. Deer at least sort of leap, but these cows just kind of amble. It's a huge bull, and he doesn't like it when you drive down the road at all. So this is one. Out of the fog, a herd of wild cattle, two heifers locking horns on the road while I try to steer the truck around them without getting involved. I thought I knew where I was going when I set out, but now I'm not so sure. And just a few more. This is one from a book called When the World Is Not Our Home. It's a selected poems. And there was no garden here when we arrived, only my father's house in stony pasture, and a crucifix nailed to a stunted medlar to hex the snakes, hundreds of them, who slipped their way out of the dark earth to bathe under the shedding sun. I was the kind of kid who could whop a snake from here to kingdom come. That was my father's expression, from here to kingdom come. When you've had your father's blood on your face, how can you write about it? When you walk around in the hat he shot his head off in, what can you write? I loved his brown eyes, his voice, the scent of his pipe tobacco, like wildflower honey mixed with wind. I imagined the smell of the honeysuckle he promised to plant each fall, as if anything could take hold in that place and grow. The night he left, he told me, next year I will plant my best garden ever. And I knew, like all the other mysteries of his life, it would exclude me. I can still see the way he pulled the brim of that hat down over his eyes. And I still hear those snakes in the black hole of this earth plotting their own garden where they could crawl from here to kingdom come, trying to understand what it took to be a man. I actually stole that from Courtney Love, and she said something about her father shooting his head, face off, and wearing the same hat. So you know how your poems work, you take things from other people, and then everybody thinks I've had this awful life where all these things have happened to me. Really, it's all stolen. Well, not all of it, the good part of it. And if it weren't stolen, probably I wouldn't be here. I'd be jumping off the cliff some more. Let's see, 55. So one more to end with, and it is, I hope, a cheerier poem. Well, I don't hope, I shouldn't apologize. I don't write a lot of poetry, and when I do, it goes to that these kinds of places, the darker places. My creative nonfiction is more humorous, and my novels are just neurotic, you know. Writing fiction is a very neurotic process compared to poetry. I think you have to work day after day after day and not miss a day, otherwise it's hard to get back into. This poem is, I read signs wherever I go, and they're great signs in Ireland, but one of my favorite I saw was rest area, no loitering. And so I was commissioned to write a poem about Canada I think it was the millennium. And so I decided to write about signs. Signs of the Times, it's called. Pick your rut carefully, you will be in it for the next 80 miles, warned a sign on a stretch of bad road near head smashed in Buffalo Jump, Alberta. That's a real place, by the way. I love my country because even though we have been called the Vichysois of nations, cold, half French, and difficult to stir, we're honestly everything we pretend to be, one nation of 80 ethnic groups who still base our fashion taste on what doesn't itch. If the United States is like the guy at the party who gives everyone cocaine and still can't get anybody to like him, north of the 49th parallel, where all our Christmases are white, Canadians are the life of the party. God gave us memories so we could have roses in winter, they say, in Manitoba. But on Vancouver Island, we know the cold of a Canadian winter can kill even a memory. Gather ye rosebuds was my old father's best advice. The average Canadian considers life too short to stuff a mushroom, thinks poutine is French cuisine, is too polite to take the last piece of Christmas cake from the plate, the last pierogi from the pot. The average Canadian says, I'm sorry, 4.8 times a minute. We are a self-effacing nation, a well-mannered lot. Americans say no to drugs, Canadians say no thank you. We are not elitist, says our new Governor General, ask anyone who matters. Canadians are unarmed Americans with health care. A sign on the door of the Ontario legislature reads, warning to all personnel, firings will continue until morale improves. Red Fox said health nuts are going to feel stupid someday, lying in hospital, dying of nothing, but the unarmed in Canada will be covered. If I had my life to live over, I'd live over Haida Bucks in Masset on Haida Gwaii, order skim milk latte made from organic shade-grown beans only. Whenever I felt lonely, I'd drive down to Margaret's Cafe in Queen Charlotte City, where a sign immemorial says tomorrow has been cancelled due to lack of interest. I'd order spaghetti to go. What person on this planet can feel lonely while eating spaghetti? My new philosophy for the millennium, dread one day at a time. Wake up on New Year's Day and smell what's left of the roses. Pick your rut carefully, but remember, better to be behind a police car than in front of one. When you die, there's going to be a big vacuum in your life, so make hay while the sun still shines through the ozone layer. Raise a glass to the future, taste the stars. Thank you very much.